This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We're on strike to prevent the studios and the streamers from eliminating our profession and turning our career into gig jobs. We're not at war against individuals here. We're at war against capitalism. You know, we're at war against Wall Street.
The Writers Guild of America West is on strike. One of their demands is that the use of artificial intelligence in their work be regulated.
The real key to dynamism, economic, social dynamism and development in the Horn of Africa is the Eritrean-Ethiopian connection. So, of course, that's something that Washington wants to break up.
The U.S. is holding up Ethiopia's IMF loan request to pressure the country's government into taking its distance from China, Russia, and most of all, Eritrea.
We are not guilty of the absurd charges that we are Russian spies deployed by the Kremlin to disrupt the St. Pete local elections.
And the Uhuru 3 speak out against the U.S. government's attempt to criminalize free speech. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. For those of you who have been listening to our show, COVID, Race, and Democracy, a weekly hour created by the Pacifica National Board at the outset of the COVID pandemic, is now Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We will continue to cover COVID, but we've reimagined ourselves as we broadened our coverage over the 3 years we've been broadcasting. Now, on with the show. The striking Writers Guild of America West workers are fighting some of the biggest tech companies in the world. Here are voices from the picket line recorded by KPFK LA's Shankar Singham.
I'm sitting here on Sunset Boulevard in front of Netflix. As you see, the writer strike is right behind me. I interview two screenwriters to see how they feel the protest is going.
So, hey, what's your name?
Henry Gamble.
Henry, are you a writer?
I am a writer, yeah.
Anything I might have heard of?
Shows for Netflix, a little bit on Fox, a show called F is for Family, starring Bill Burr, hilarious cartoon. Everybody go check it out.
So, why are you out here, man? What's going on? You were just telling me something about a 2% raise. What was going on with that?
The bottom line is the middle class of writers is being squeezed out of the industry right now. The people who are in charge would love to just hoard the wealth and keep it at the top. We're not asking for everything they have. All we want is a 2% share of profits. 2% share would cover everything that we're asking for, and apparently that's unreasonable. Rooms are getting smaller, episode orders are getting shorter, profits are through the roof. The companies would love to have you believe that they're hurting financially. We know for a fact that's not the case, because on one hand, they'll brag to their shareholders about how well the numbers are and how high profits are, and then they'll come to us and they'll cry poverty. So,
wow.
It's if you got any sense at all, you can see it's a bunch of, I don't want to curse on your radio station.
My name is Adam Conover. I'm a writer and I'm a showrunner and a TV host, and I'm also a member of the Writers Guild of America West Board of Directors and the our 2023 negotiating committee.
Just for curiosity, have you written anything I might have heard of? Anything?
Yeah, I created the show Adam Ruins Everything and also a show for Netflix called The G Word.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah.
So, why the strike?
We're on strike to prevent the studios and the streamers from eliminating our profession and turning our career into gig jobs. They want to eliminate the writer's room, and they want to force screenwriters who write movies to do endless revisions for free. They want to force late night writers, people who do the kind of work I do, to, you know, instead of having 13-week contracts, they want to give us a day rate where they can hire us one day and fire us the next day. If we allow those things to happen, writing, television and film writing will cease to be a career, a middle class career in Los Angeles. Instead, it'll be a gig job where, you know, maybe you can make a couple extra $100 as a side hustle. And we don't want to see that happen. So we're on strike to fight for the protections that we need in our contract.
So it sounds like you guys have good energy out here.
Yeah.
How long do you think you guys can sustain this?
We'll be out here as long as they need us to be before they get it, you know. The CEOs are the ones who are going to decide how long we're out here.
And who exactly is that? Who are the CEOs that...
Ted Sarandos, David Zaslav, Bob Iger, you know, there's a whole bunch of them. These are the people who hide behind this organization called the AMPTP, which is the first organization we negotiate with. But really, it's up to the CEOs. And once they remember and they realize that they have no product without us, we're the ones who make every single show that they release. Once they realize that they need us, and they don't have any product without us, they're going to come down out of those towers and negotiate with us. We're not at war against individuals here. We're at war against capitalism. You know, we're at war against Wall Street, forcing these companies to chase short-term profits. And how do they do that? By squeezing labor. Sure. So we're here to starve the beast of the product, and in so doing, force it to come back to the table with us. It's not really about those individual people, because they are just, you know, the vehicles of, right, of capitalism.
Sure. They're just doing what the shareholders want.
Exactly. And you know, some of them might be more amenable than others to seeing reason and coming to the table. But, it's not... If you replace Ted Sarandos, another guy like him... Another guy like him just walks right in and takes the job.
So you're... Yeah. So you come down... Oh, that's...
Yeah, I mean, this is an old-fashioned union fight, you know? It's a war of attrition. We're starving them out, you know? So just like, you know, auto workers have gone on strike over the last century, and that's the reason we think of working in an American auto factory as being a good paying job. The writers historically have done the same thing for the last 100 years. You know, we've gone on strike when we need to. That's the only reason I have a health plan, a pension plan. That's the only reason why I get residuals, why I have minimum compensation, why writing is a middle class job in Los Angeles and New York at all. And now it's our turn to wage that same battle, and remind them that, you know, just like with the auto workers are picketing outside the factory, no cars are coming out, right? Well, if the writers are picketing outside your facility, you don't have any TV shows. And that's all they make, right? They think they're wizards up there. They think, oh, we're the money wizards. We're in control of anything, of everything. No, they're not. We're the ones who make this stuff, right? So if you don't have us, you don't have anything, Ted. You don't have anything, Bob. So you better come down here and deal with us.
So you brought...
And by the way, we have immense amount of support from elected officials all across California and the country. And, you know, sure, you know, Netflix donates a lot of money too. But, you know, the folks in power know that labor is where their bread is buttered.
Is there anyone that you'd like to see come down and support you, or that's... Or are you someone that's surprised that's not supporting you?
I'd love to see Ted Sarandos come down and support us, you know? Because he talks about, oh, we're a talent-friendly business. We love our creators. Oh, we want everyone to get paid fairly. Okay, great, Ted. Well, come on down and hang out with us, you know? I went and pitched a TV show in that very building, you know? And yet, now here I am marching in front of it because of my compensation for that show, and because of the demands that they're making to change my contract and make my work more precarious. And so if you value that relationship, then you'd come down here and support us, just like so many unions, so many other business people, so many, the entire town is supporting us. Why aren't you, Ted? Come on down.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy guy, man. I'll let you get back to it.
Hey, thank you so much,
dude. For the thing with you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Sorry I'm so hoarse.
Oh, no, you sound great, bud.
We're smart. We're hot as hell, if I say so myself. We're getting steps in, vitamin D. They think this is going to make us weaker. We're just getting stronger, man. This is like summer camp for comedy writers. You know, we can do this as long as we have to.
As you can see, the writers have a lot of energy. They feel the protest is going well. Coincidentally, the Directors Guild and the Screen Actors Guild are also up for negotiations this week and the following month. So all three unions will be negotiating at the table with the studios.
Those were Voices of Writers Guild of America West members on the picket line with KPFK LA's Shankar Singham.
It's an all that glitters gold after storm.
That was Bob Marley, Get Up, Stand Up. The 11,000 members of the Writers Guild of America West, now on strike, are demanding that there be regulation and control of artificial intelligence in their work. They say that the issue is not just about writers, but about hundreds of millions of workers. Rachel Meinerding and Greg Hopps of Concept Art Association spoke to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
The big issue is that these AI generative models are powered off the back of the hardworking labor of creatives, that these data sets are powered by billions of images that were scraped without consent, without compensation, to power these data sets. So when we're looking at the impressive nature of these models, we need to be keeping in mind is the output is only as good as the input, right? Like, we have to be considering the labor and the copyrighted and the personal data that is in these AI generative models. In terms of implementation in the workplace, Greg, I think that you'll be very well suited to take that question.
You have to really focus on like the personal side of these things too. I'm an industry concept artist. I've spent my entire life evolving my skills and adapting to new technologies. I switched from watercolor in school to full digital illustrations, and we've even recently been learning like 3D sculpting. To have spent my life dedicated to this, just to have my entire catalog of professional and personal work scraped into these generative AI program data sets is insane. The advent of these generative programs, it will really render all of that effort and consequently my job and thousands more like it completely obsolete. And up until this point, it has been artists using technology to aid in their work, but now it's the technology using the artist. I absolutely believe in this kind of technological progress, but it just can't come at the cost of the creatives, the working class creatives' livelihoods. It just can't. But when it comes to the implementation in our industry, the film industry, specifically film and television entertainment industry, they've been very cautious to use this. Right now, it's very much on the hush-hush. People are not admitting that they're using it because of the copyright issues. The studios are basically, in my opinion, are taking a seat and waiting to see how this gets handled. But from their perspective, any opportunity to cut costs and to increase production, programs like these are their dream. So they're waiting to see how they can use these programs to their advantage. And I think when you look at the video game industry, they've already, the vast majority of like the top three major video game companies have already put out regulations internally saying we do not use these until the copyright issues have been resolved. Because these programs have taken this artwork without crediting or compensating any of these artists. So it's a massive issue that no one quite has figured out how to handle, but it's just causing havoc internally within these industries.
And the idea that you can, as you say, scrape all your work from your albums, from decades of work as an artist, that must be a very frightening thing. Everything you produce is taken away, and then you don't know how it's used, and somebody is profiting from it and using it for their own purposes, and you're not getting compensated, and you don't even know about it.
Yeah. It's, as far as I'm concerned, it is one of the largest scales of copyright theft that has ever taken place in history. We need to understand that this is slowly increasing to the entirety of the internet at this point. It is scraping photos, images, videos, every piece of data that it can collect, and we have put it out into the world, and it's just been unprotected, and it hasn't been an issue up until this point where it's not compensated. These companies are making so much money off of this, and it was done without the consent or crediting or compensation of any of these artists.
And Rachel, I mean, if the work of artists, creators, writers, and the kind of work that your members do is not compensated, what does that mean about the future?
You know, it could be dire, right? Like, this could have a massive impact. You know, if we want to get like real doomsday, which I don't necessarily want to, but like Greg mentioned, this is not about the Hollywood elite here. We're talking about working middle class folk who are, for the most part, freelancers that rely, you know, the mid to senior people might be okay, but their contracts are definitely going to be reduced. And we're already seeing that. People are not going to be able to afford to live. Like, people might have to leave California. Like, if they're not, if there's no work in California for artists, like, how are people going to be able to afford to live here? And the knock-on effect that could have, the United States is not built up to support that type of mass unemployment. It could be really bad. You know, one thing that we're learning is, you know, we need to have a focus. There's so many angles that you can approach with this. And right now, it's the major issue is copyright, which is also why the US Copyright Office are holding their listening sessions to, you know, get the opinions of, you know, different folks that exist in the IP space, because that, you know, in terms of the future of this, you know, a big part of that will be dictated by, is generative AI output copyrightable?
Oh, Greg?
I was just going to add on to that. It's also that conversation of where does art start and stop? I mean, Rachel, one of the most interesting things that I've had an experience of listening to is talking with members of the National Association of Voice Actors. To pivot from art as something that is generated and on a paper, when you talk to voice actors, and I apologize, I don't speak for the voice actors, I'm just trying to convey what I've heard. This discussion of their voices are what they are marketing. They have a contract with a company that has specific parameters of whether or not they are allowed to work for other companies while working for them. So their voice is being licensed to that company and is considered proprietary. But to what extent is someone allowed to take their voice, train a data set off of that, and then use it? All of a sudden, the legalities of this, like Rachel said, it can pivot and ping pong to thousands, if not millions, of different arenas where this becomes insanely problematic. It's if the art that I create with my hands is able to be stolen, as well as the voice of someone, the voice out of someone's mouth, this, the ethical regulations that really do need to come from this are incredibly necessary, because unchecked, this just goes wild. It's, what is it, like the Greek story of the Hydra? You chop one head off, another two grow in its place. It's really have to find a way to handle this situation.
It sounds like a could be catastrophic to humanity. I mean, if your labor and the labor of artists, workers, others can be just captured and used, misused, or used for profit in a corporation without any compensation whatsoever. I mean, when we talk about the Industrial Revolution, a lot of people were put out of work by the Industrial Revolution. But here, it's even greater than the Industrial Revolution.
Without regulations, this could decimate the film industry. This could put out of work the hair and makeup, costume department, costume designers, costume concept art, the entirety of the art department, not to mention production. It's the wide sweeping of just the text-to-image generative programs in our industry unregulated could not only put us out of a job, which is one thing, but for how many generations to come, is our artists, upcoming artists, students, people who want to get into this industry, it's not going to be a viable job for them anymore.
And it seems like when we talk about a gold rush, I mean, there are people who think that they can grab all this stuff and then use it to make great amounts of profit. In fact, I mean, if they start doing this, doesn't it even threaten the movie studios themselves, that people can take the art produced in a movie and just use it for their own purposes or their own projects? I mean, it seems like there's no end if you allow this kind of thing.
Totally. I think the kind of what Greg was saying with the guilds, they're all kind of waiting to see where it lands, because there's a chance that major movie studios could build their own. They can build their own, you know, AI generative models using their own copyrighted material. So I think I can't say that I've seen any studio come out publicly and sort of say, we're not going to use this, because I think they're waiting to be like, oh, maybe we could build our own generative AI based on all of our own copyright material. And I think that's something potentially that we could see. And that will still affect people, right? Like they could, you know, what I would like to see happen is, you know, boilerplate language being put in contracts on work for hire contracts to be like, I don't consent to my work being uploaded to, you know, whatever studio data set that you guys are creating, but that still has to come in solidarity. Like everyone has to be asking for that. You know, to kind of go back on the one of the things that Greg mentioned, you know, people, you know, they sometimes take this at kind of face value of like, oh, an artist lost their job because someone was able to create an image from a generative AI model. But what I think sometimes people forget is, okay, you lost, if we're talking about, for example, something that looks photoreal, something that looks like a photograph, the model lost out on work, the photographer's assistant, the studio space that was rented, the driver that took them to the place, the hair and makeup, whatever assistant they had, catering, PAs. Like, it's not just like, oh, boohoo, an artist lost a job or a photographer lost a job. It's like, no, it's all those other people that are affected by that one thing that, you know, and just to put this in context, this is not like, oh, small time studios doing this. Cosmopolitan did an AI generated cover about 4 months ago now, I guess, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, which feels hugely disrespectful to the people that work at their magazine. That's just something that we need to be remembering from like a labor standpoint, that this is not just about one person losing work because a text to prompt can create an image. It's all the other people that are that are missing out on that work.
Because that's a lot of people in the United States.
That's a lot of people.
And it's when you look at the size of, even again, keeping it to the state of California, it's California's what, the third largest economy in the world? Fourth largest economy in the world. When you think about how much of that is the entertainment industry alone and the entertainment industry that really helped build California, if you start taking major swipes at that, that's not just a US issue. That's not even just a California issue. That's not even just a US issue. That's a global issue.
We just heard from Greg Hopps and Rachel Meinerding from Concept Art Association, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. That was Ben Harper singing Better Way. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. The U.S. is holding up Ethiopia's request for a $2 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund for post-war reconstruction and development. I spoke to Robert J. Prince, retired senior lecturer at the University of Denver's Korbel School of International Studies. He is also a political commentator at Pacifica affiliate KGNU Boulder. Ethiopia is asking the International Monetary Fund for a $2 billion loan to fund post-war reconstruction and development. However, the loan remains in limbo. A source who preferred to remain anonymous told me that the U.S. is holding it up, demanding accountability for wartime atrocities, but that their real goal is forcing Ethiopia to distance itself from Russia and China, but most of all, Eritrea. That sounds plausible, but what do you think?
I'm not at all surprised that the loan request is in limbo, as Washington has been putting all kinds of pressure on Ethiopia for some time, and this is just another form of pressure. Indeed, putting all the pieces together, although it claims otherwise, that Washington has been engaged in nothing short of what I would call hybrid warfare against Ethiopia since Abiy Ahmed has been elected, and the games being played with the IMF loan are simply one element of that. And concerning Washington's claims of Ethiopian government atrocities, Washington is well aware, though the administration is well aware, that the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, tried to regain power militarily and failed. The TPLF has essentially been Washington's proxy in the region. It was war, and in war, unfortunately, atrocities are committed. But most of the documentation that I have seen places the atrocities on the TPLF side of the fence, and they have been, quite frankly, horrific. Having failed to overthrow the Abe government and bring the TPLF to power, the United States tried diplomatically through the Pretoria Accords, which Washington orchestrated from the sidelines, saving the TPLF from complete defeat. And economically, the pressure that is being put on them through this IMF agreement is another example of that. Let's just look for a moment at the comment about Eritrea. And in my mind, there's no doubt that one of the main targets of Washington in the Horn of Africa is the Eritrean government. We need to keep a couple of things in mind, given the wall of bad press that Eritrea gets in this country. And that is that Eritrea is the only country in Africa that has refused AFRICOM forces, that is American military forces in Africa. And the other thing, less known and less appreciated, if you like, is that Eritrea also refuses to accept IMF and World Bank loans with their structural adjustment aspects. I don't think there's any other country in Africa that has done that either. So this is really the main reason for the hostility that Washington has towards Eritrea. But you have to add something else. So just as a matter of going back a little bit, I was recently reading a book about Ethiopia. It's called The Lion of Judah in the New World, and the author is Theodore Vestal, Oklahoma State University prof. And in that book, he makes a comment about Henry Kissinger's policy towards the Horn of Africa. And then we're talking 1972, 1973, but it really sets the stage very nicely. And what Vestal notes is that in some National Security Council secret document, which I've yet to find, he said the best thing for Washington's policy in the Horn of Africa is to keep the region divided and pitted one side against another. Think about what's happening now, the carving up of Sudan, the splitting up of Somalia that you're reporting on these days, and then the ethnic conflicts that continue to hurt Ethiopia. That this is classic Kissinger and divide and rule kind of stuff. So that's, if you like, the context of that. And the opposite of that is Ethiopia trying to make regional alliances, both for economic and political reasons. And from what I can tell, the strength, the real key to dynamism, economic, social dynamism and development in the Horn of Africa is the Eritrean-Ethiopian connection. So, of course, that's something that Washington wants to break up. In terms of all the bad press it gets, it's very difficult for me to analyze what's fact and what's fiction in U.S. reporting in Eritrea. I don't follow it at all because I feel it's so one-sided.
Okay. The same source who preferred to remain anonymous told me that China is Ethiopia's largest bilateral creditor. So, therefore, the U.S. thinks that China should take on more responsibility in terms of the bailout package. Let's quote, China should take on more responsibility in terms of the bailout package. However, the Chinese want the IMF to foot the bill, unquote. since you know more about the IMF than I do, could you interpret?
Yes. Now, I have to admit that I have not seen the proposal. All right. I've not seen what the request was. So what I'm curious about is, what is it that Ethiopia is specifically asking for in terms of what kind of aid in this package? But typically speaking, we need to remember certain things about the IMF and the World Bank without going into a lot of the details. While they claim to be international organizations, and of course, to a certain extent they are, they're US run and dominated. And since the late 1970s, early 1980s, IMF aid has attachments to it, has conditions, and those conditions are known as structural adjustment, basically. Structural adjustment, really, it's been discredited by academics all over the world for 35, 40 years, that it doesn't lead to development, it leads to greater debt. So how would this particular proposal be any different from other IMF proposals? I don't know. But in terms of the broader geopolitical question, let's just be frank about what's happening in the Horn of Africa. And here I would like to take a specific example that relates to major foreign aid and major funding. And that has been the attitude towards the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which has the potential of really creating a kind of economic dynamism in the Horn of Africa, not just in Ethiopia, that hasn't existed until now. Ethiopia went on several occasions to the IMF and the World Bank asking for financial aid to help build the dam. They didn't get it. And in fact, most of the funding for that dam has come from the Ethiopian people themselves, which is quite moving. So this is their dam. And this is their dam, whether they're Oromo, Tigray, Amhara, Somali, it doesn't really matter. So the creation of this dam is one of the few counterbalancing forces that I see to all this ethnic tension and dissent. Everyone has a place in that dam, and not just Ethiopia, because this dam, when completed, and it's near completion right now, it's going to provide electricity for the entire region. And without electricity, development is difficult to impossible. Now, where do the Chinese fit into this? The Chinese are the only major foreign country, to my knowledge, that have funded, at least in part, this dam. As I recall, I haven't seen the statistics for a couple of years, but the dam, the figures I remember were about $6 billion, most of which came from the Ethiopian people, but about $1 billion came from the Chinese. So you've got that big project. So in the midst of all this ethnic tension that we're seeing, the dam brings Ethiopians together and brings the Horn together. What's the U.S. position been and the World Bank position been on this dam? They've opposed it. They've opposed it down the line. They've thrown monkey wrenches in it. So this is the kind of project that the IMF and the United States refuses to fund. And this is the kind of project that the Chinese in particular welcome and have helped. So there's that part of it. When I look at this Chinese, Russian on the one hand and American competition for Ethiopia and for Africa in general, what we're really seeing here is the reemergence of the politics and the vision of the non-aligned nations movement of the 1950s. If you get really down to it, very few of the countries really want to take a side in this new Cold War that's been emerging. Their position is, they want to be able to deal with both China and the United States. But this is unacceptable. The barrier here, the monkey wrench, is Washington's policies. So in any case, I don't want to go on for too long. This whole thing is being played out worldwide. It's being played out in Africa. And the people of Africa are making it really clear that they're trying not to take a side in this conflict, and that both sides have a possibility of, if they want to, if you like, to help. I was thinking the other day about how could U.S. policy towards Ethiopia change to make it more constructive? I don't see that happening, by the way, but invest in infrastructure.
They don't do that.
All this military, the military buildup that we're seeing in the region, it's only causing more conflict. And you want to compete with the Chinese, which I think can be done. The United States still has tremendous resources and has the ability to do it. Then ask the Ethiopians what kind of aid they want. And that's the kind of competition. It would be a win-win situation. There's no need for it to be any other. But I don't see our government moving this direction at all.
No, they don't fund development. They fund aid.
Yes.
Which creates dependency. Okay. What do you think might be the consequence if Ethiopia doesn't get this $2 billion loan? Calling it a bailout makes it sound dire. So I'm wondering whether you think they'll default on debt if they don't get the bailout and what that might mean.
There's going to be a lot of pressure, economic pressure put on Ethiopia from the West, from the United States and Europe. One has to just expect that the purpose of this pressure is to get Ethiopia to go along, if you like, with American priorities. And what I see with the current government is really trying to balance, if you like, the input from both sides of this new Cold War. Mm-hmm. So I see additional pressure. Is Ethiopia going to collapse? No, it won't. But it's going to be a more difficult situation for the country. The other side of it is I was really surprised. On the one hand, we're reading about the Tigray War frozen for a moment. Now we have all these terrible massacres taking place in the Oromo region and elsewhere. So it looks like the country's falling apart. But when you look at the economic indicators, it's not. In spite of all of this, the Ethiopian economy is growing. And regional integration, to a certain degree, is taking place. Looking at this region, they are tired of war, of factionalism, of the kind of sectarian policies that have marked the region for so long. All of these countries, they want to find the common ground. And so is that approach going to win out? I believe so, that it will in the end, but not without a lot of pain and struggle in the years ahead.
Okay. I think maybe just for those who might not understand this, might not be so familiar with the IMF, maybe you could explain what structural adjustment means. What the IMF demands in exchange for these loans and bailouts.
Okay, good question. What structural adjustment is conditioning. Countries must go in a certain direction in order to get the money that they need, that they're starving for, if you like. And all right, meaning that they're forced to open up their economies to foreign intervention, whether it's investment, whether it's simply trade. And for a country that's trying to develop economically, really doesn't matter whether it's on a capitalist or socialist model, that in the initial stages of economic development, there's some kind of protectionism that's almost required a certain amount of time. What structural adjustment does is it eliminates that possibility of a young emerging economy to develop to the point where it can compete globally. So that's one part of it, opening up to foreign trade. And foreign trade is always going to have a great advantages over a country that's just come out of colonialism, if you like, or newly found independence one way or another. Their economies are weak. So they need some form, and it varies, some form of protectionism and some form of government support for their economic development. Structural adjustment severely limits the role of a government helping its country get off its feet. That's really the heart of the matter. And then there are other conditions, and all the conditions, not all, but most of them, go in the direction of cutting government's role in what? In education, in healthcare, in transportation, in infrastructural development, so that these areas then are increasingly taken over by foreign players. As that happens, it's inevitable that these countries can't compete. Their debt grows larger and larger, and therefore they have to come back to the IMF or the World Bank for further aid, and they get caught in a debt cycle. So this is the problem of structural adjustment.
Don't they typically wind up using the money they borrow to pay interest on the debt, and giving it right back to the people who loaned it to them while getting deeper in debt?
Yes, they do. They do that. The other thing that happens is there's so much corruption that gets involved in this that money just disappears. So they've set up a system that's very hard to get out of. It's an endless cycle of growing poverty and social problems. and of greater economic interference from larger countries, but particularly Washington and the Europeans to a certain degree. When I first looked at this policy, and that was 30, even more years ago, I couldn't believe it could last that long because it's so punitive. But now it's coming apart. All this stuff we're seeing, countries that are, we don't want to deal in the dollar anymore, yet we will have exchanges with China and yen. These are attempts to get off of exactly these kind of policies. And the interesting thing is, who is it that is looking at IMF policies and saying, we've had it? Well, virtually the entire global South, the entire global South. One last point on these policies. It's much easier for these policies to be instituted on poor countries. But when the United States tried to do that, or the World Bank, IMF, tried to do that with China and Russia, and even Iran, which they have not succeeded. So it's been these middle and larger economies. They danced with the IMF for a certain amount of time until they realized this is not in our interest, and they pulled back.
Okay. Thank you, Rob Prince, for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Robert J. Prince, retired senior lecturer at the University of Denver's Korbel School of International Studies and political commentator at Pacifica affiliate KGNU Boulder, Colorado.
Come at the Wood Bank Brothers, and some African fools. Give them title, make them come rule. They say, do as I tell you, lie to your people. They go say, do as I tell you, teach your people. Or they go say, IMF, no, what best for me? IMF, no, no, what best for me? Tonight is IMF, no, what best for me? Tell them IMF, no, no, what best for me? So go give $1 to the boys and now for the people. Get back 20 in the name of debt from the people. We never see no dollar, my people.
Never see no end,
my people.
Where the dollars at? Where the money go? City talk fast, but they move slow. Pop champagne and make it rain. Go down the drain. Who feel the pain? The president take the money and hide it. And celebrate while the people divide it. Over here we call it poverty pimping. They bootlicking the people the victim. Kissing the ass of white power. My people are coming for what's ours. Going all out cause it's now or never. Breaking the chain, we gon' sever. The head of the parasite, we taking it there tonight. They have about to shut your mouth. Yeah, you're right. Excuse my friends, the colonizers. Trickologists, cheaters, and liars.
Oh, they see how depend where they come with your knowing.
International model shuts down.
Oh, they see how we debt and how we money they fall down.
International model shuts down.
We look at our land, tell them for an investment.
That was Sharon Kuti singing IMF. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. On April 18, the U.S. government announced indictments against the Uhuru Three, African People's Socialist Party Chairman Amalia Shetela, African People's Solidarity Committee Chair Penny Hess, and Uhuru Solidarity Movement Chair Jesse Neville, on federal charges that they are pawns of the Russian government and are spreading Russian propaganda. On May 10, the Uhuru Three spoke to the press for the first time since their April 18 indictments. They said the charges imply that Black people can't think or speak for themselves. Here are highlights from the press conference.
My name is Jesse Neville. I am a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee and the chair of our mass organization, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, also known as USM. I am also one of the Uhuru Three indicted on bogus charges by the federal government on April 18th, along with Penny Hess and Chairman Amalia Shetela, who is the primary target of these vicious attacks. As APSC's mass organization, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement works under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party with the strategic purpose of extending the struggle for African liberation into the white population. Based on the strategy and leadership of Chairman Amalia Shetela, our work is to organize white people to turn our backs on a social system built on slavery, genocide, and colonialism for our benefit, and to join the rest of humanity by fighting for reparations to African people. I have had the honor to be a part of this organization for the past 13 years. And in 2017, I was asked by Chairman Amalia Shetela and the African People's Socialist Party to run for mayor of St. Petersburg, Florida on the campaign platform of unity through reparations. In addition to reiterating what we said at the arraignments held this past Monday and the previous Tuesday, that we are not guilty of the absurd charges that we are Russian spies deployed by the Kremlin to disrupt the St. Pete local elections, I would like to add that I firmly and proudly stand in complete solidarity and unity with the African People's Socialist Party, the Uhuru Movement, Chairman Omalia Shetela, the Uhuru House, the Black community of St. Petersburg, and African and oppressed peoples everywhere. I denounce these horrific attacks on their presumed right to freedom of speech and political expression by the US government's so-called Department of Justice. These charges are illegitimate, and we should all be outraged and disgusted at this blatant, despicable, and shameful campaign of repression that the US government is waging against Chairman Omalia Shetela and the Uhuru Movement. The charges against the chairman, Penny, and myself are false, but they are not just false. They're false to an idiotic and laughable extreme. As Penny Hess just said, and as the chairman clearly demonstrated, anyone who knows anything about Chairman Omalia Shetela knows how ridiculous the notion is that anyone is behind the scenes pulling the strings, telling Chairman Omalia Shetela what to say or do. It is such an offensive and slanderous allegation that to even dignify it with the response feels inappropriate. For more than 60 years of his life, Chairman Omalia Shetela has fought for the liberation and unification of Africa and African people, freedom for Black people. That has been his life for over six decades. He has built a global movement empowering and uplifting African people to reclaim their own agency and self-determination over their lives and resources. Under his leadership, the Uhuru Movement has built political and economic programs in the hands of the African working class on nearly every continent. Today in St. Louis, Missouri, where I live, the Uhuru Movement has built a program called the Black Power Blueprint that has brought life and hope back to the deeply impoverished North Side, building community centers, gardens, farmers markets, housing and workforce programs for formerly incarcerated African people, trainings for doulas and midwives, and is now working to construct a Black Women's Health Center to build community-based solutions to the grave and genocidal rates of infant and maternal mortality faced by African women in this country. The US government is attempting to put Chairman Omalia Shetela in prison, not because they actually believe he's a Russian agent, but because they know who he really is. Just like they knew who Martin Luther King really was, who Marcus Garvey really was, who Malcolm X really was, who Fred Hampton really was, a freedom fighter for his people and for the oppressed peoples of the world. But they can't openly say that. They can't openly charge Chairman Omalia Shetela with being an agent of freedom. So they lie. And charge him as an agent of some so-called foreign power that we're all supposed to be afraid of. And in the same indictment, they charge myself and Penny Hess, again, not because they actually think we are working for the Russians, but because they know who we work for, the African Liberation Movement, because they know we work under the leadership, or as they like to say, subject to the influence and direction of, not the Russians, but the African People's Socialist Party. We speak not for some foreign malign influence, but for the millions of other white people out there who refuse to be complicit with our own government's unceasing state-sanctioned terror and violence against African people. As the world recently witnessed once again with the public lynching of Jordan Neely by a white man in New York who has not even been arrested or charged with a crime, or by the countless other acts of colonial brutality against Black women, children, and men every day. Despite the government's best efforts to scare white people away from standing in solidarity with the African Liberation Movement, more and more of us are becoming co-conspirators too and joining the Uhuru Solidarity Movement in over 140 cities throughout this country under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party and Chairman Omalia Shetela. Again, our slogan given to us by our leadership, Chairman Omalia Shetela, is unity through reparations. And our message for the white community and to all who believe in freedom is to join the Hands Off Uhuru, Hands Off Africa campaign. Hands Off Uhuru means hands off freedom of speech, hands off the First Amendment, hands off freedom of political expression and assembly. If Chairman Omalia Chatella's right to freedom of speech is nullified, then even the presumption of freedom of speech itself will be gone. Now is the time to send a message to the government that you will not stand by and do nothing. Demand these charges be dropped. Donate to the Legal Defense Fund at handsoffuhuru.org/donate. Join the fight back. We will win. Hands off Chairman Omalia Chatella. Hands off Penny Hess. Hands off Uhuru. Hands off Africa. Unity through reparations. Thank you.
All right, Chairman.
And in this country, the part of the mythos of this country revolves around the fact that the people who left Europe and came here at the expense of the indigenous people and what have you, did so in a struggle against the feudal nobility of England. And they put forth various principles that they wanted to have so that they couldn't have kings telling them to shut up and don't say this and don't say that. They want the right to tell the kings to shut up. And part of what they did was, you might call it, coming out of that process, the weaponization of free speech. Free speech, free speech. That's what I was taught, free speech. That's what they said when they went against the will of George and other despots throughout Europe, free speech. That's what we're talking about. That's what this is about, notwithstanding press releases that you get from the Justice Department, free speech. They have never accused us of hurting anybody, stealing from anybody. It's free speech, that's the question. Not the stock market or anything else, no, none of that stuff. Not even doing dirty things with election, not scaling the walls of the Capitol, not defecating on Nancy Pelosi's desk. Free speech, the right for Black people to speak up in our own interests. And here's a contradiction that we are confronted with all the time that makes too many white people vulnerable to this kind of nonsense, is that for the longest period of time, white people have been subjects of history and African people have only been objects of history. We've never been able to tell our own story. And so because we have been objects of history, that's been told by somebody else, when we begin to speak for ourselves, we don't tell the same story. And because we don't tell the same story, it can be disturbing. You've never heard anybody say this about you before. And so now you hear the slave defining the slave master, as opposed to the slave master always doing all of the defining, and you find out to your surprise that the slave doesn't feel the same way about the slave master as the slave master feels about himself. Yes. That's the contradiction that we're dealing with.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. So that will conclude today's press conference. Again, I really want to salute our leadership, Chairman Omalia Chatella, comrades Penny Hess, Jesse Neville, our incredible legal counsel, all of the community members for coming out today. And for those who are watching and watching us online as well as in the media, handsoffuhuru.org/donate. Drop the charges against Chairman Omalia Chatella, Penny Hess, Jesse Neville, the Uhuru 3. Hands off Uhuru, hands off Africa. Uhuru.
An International Day of Action will be held on Saturday, May 27, to demand that the U.S. government drop the charges against the Uhuru 3. To learn more and get involved, visit handsoffuhuru.org. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the CRD Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button and follow us on Twitter at @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.